Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. A heat wave, a blizzard, a major power outage, an outbreak of infectious disease. Each of these things has the potential to bring daily life to a standstill. And when things like this happen, often it is the most disadvantaged people who are the most vulnerable and who suffer the most. So here's the question. How well prepared is government at all levels, federal, state, and local, to deal with natural disaster? And in fact, how prepared are we as individuals? What could we do to be better prepared? We'll perhaps also talk about how it is that the media talks about this and whether, in fact, we're giving people good, solid information or maybe sometimes we're scaring people unnecessarily. All of these questions this morning we'll take up with our guest, Eric Kleinenberg. He's professor of sociology at New York University. And in his academic work, he's interested in risk and disaster. His very first book took a look at the heat wave that hit Chicago back in July of 1995, and it won a number of awards. That book is Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. It was published by the University of Chicago Press. His second book is about media. The title of that book is Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. Right now, he's working on a couple of different projects that relate back to this subject of risk and disaster. He's looking at urban security, the rise of disaster expertise, and the range of policy responses to emerging concerns about urban risk and vulnerability. He's also interested in and involved in a multi-year study of the rise in living alone, and there are definitely some connections between those two things. You certainly could see that when you look at what happened in Chicago back in 1995. So we'll talk a little bit, try to talk about some of these things here this morning with our guest, Eric Kleinenberg. And as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. And that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask is that people are brief with their comments and questions so we can get in as many folks as possible. But certainly, callers are welcome. Professor Kleinenberg, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
And we appreciate it. And at some point here, soon here, I want to talk a little bit about heat wave in Chicago in 95, and maybe we can use that as a kind of a case study of what we're talking about here.
But I understand heat is on your mind in Illinois.
Well, definitely so. I'm right here looking at the heat index, and we are a lot of our area, in fact, a lot of the state is under a heat advisory, and we're looking at very high heat indices, probably over 100 degrees in a lot of places. So we're right back there again.
See, I don't have to check the weather because I just know from the number of times my phone rings what the temperature is like.
Oh, I see. So whenever it gets hot, someone says, hey, let's call Eric Kleinenberg.
How'd you guess? Yeah. Exactly.
Well, as a kind of a general question, I'm sure for a lot of people, when it comes to disaster preparedness, dealing with emergencies, a lot of people would say, well, 9/11 was the wake-up call. It showed just how poorly prepared we were to deal with something like that. So we started thinking a lot about that. We started thinking more about what we used to call civil defense in all of its various incarnations. And then comes Katrina. And that shows us, in fact, it seems that we didn't learn very much or things didn't change very much after 9/11, despite all of the talking and everything that we did. So now, all this time after both of those events, do you think that we are any better positioned to deal with some major natural disaster, something weather-related, or I suppose it could be an intentional act, or it could be infectious disease? How well prepared do you think we are?
Now, I wish we could say that we're very well prepared, but I just think there's no evidence of that right now. In fact, here at NYU, we did a number of surveys with New Yorkers after both September 11th and Hurricane Katrina, and we found that at the kind of civilian level, there's very little change in the way that people prepare themselves and their families, even after those incredibly disastrous events. So, you know, I think there's this kind of longstanding puzzle, which we might get into, that concerns why it is that we're all so reluctant to do the really basic things that we could do to keep ourselves more safe. And then there's another level of the question, which is not about us as individuals or as families, but that's about our political programs or policy programs for addressing disaster. And there's still a lot of concern in the United States about the Department of Homeland Security and this question of whether it's really doing more than it can handle adequately, and in fact, whether we've kind of transferred so many of our programs into the realm of anti-terrorism that we have neglected to deal seriously with other kinds of threats, from natural hazards to flu pandemics, which is on people's minds these days.
And I know that that's something that, that you're interested in and have written about here, the fact that we have, and to all of these kinds of things, we've, I suppose in a sense, we've militarized the response. That is, we have turned increasingly to police and law enforcement, but not just law enforcement, things that look military in their style and their structure.
Well, DHS has operated under this military style command and control system, and you probably will remember from the Katrina catastrophe, which was not just the catastrophe of the weather, but a catastrophe of politics and a bad response. That one of the transformations in DHS was to fold FEMA into this agency that had more than 180,000 employees, 22 or 23 federal agencies within it. And FEMA really lost much of its status and some of its resources. What we know from the history of disasters is that ordinary citizens and communities can actually do quite wonderful work. They are often the first responders before any government personnel get there. We find people helping themselves, and there's a kind of great mythology out there that we get from our big Hollywood movies, for instance, that when a disaster strikes, there will be mayhem and chaos. There'll be violence in the streets. People will protect themselves and step over their neighbors to get out of harm's way. But the truth from decades of research is that we do exactly the opposite. We have these kind of extraordinary outbursts of really good, helpful civic behavior. And one of my concerns, and I'm not unique in this respect, is that the kind of top-down command and control paramilitary structures that deal with disasters now, the National Guard or local police even, tend to crush our best instincts and leave us feeling helpless. And so I think it's still too early to know what this current administration, the Obama administration, is going to do with respect to disaster preparedness and emergency planning. But we certainly had a very bad record the last several years.
Our guest, just very quickly to reintroduce, is Eric Kleinenberg. He's professor of sociology at New York University. He's interested in, among other things, risk and disaster. His very first book, Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, took a look at what happened in the summer of 1995 and the city's response to a very serious heat wave there. And we're talking here this morning about how it is we think about disaster, how it is we prepare for it or don't, and how we respond to it both as individuals and how government responds. So again, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, just let's take a couple of minutes here, I would say certainly if people are interested in reading an in-depth treatment of the 95 heat wave in Chicago and what happened, they should look for the book. They can go to the bookstore, they can go to the library and find it. But just to give us the thumbnail sketch of what happened in July of 95 in Chicago.
Well, heat waves are not like earthquakes in the sense that they don't just spring upon us from nowhere. You can watch an extreme weather system moving into the place where you live for days. We do this with hurricanes, by the way, and when hurricane season comes around and we identify a violent weather system, the kind of big TV channels will interrupt regular programming to track the weather system. But we don't do this with extreme heat, and that's puzzling insofar as heat waves in the United States actually kill more people in a typical year than all of the other so-called natural disasters combined. So they're actually great public health hazards. And in the summer of 1995, this extreme weather system was moving into Chicago from the southwest. It actually killed a lot of farm animals on its way into Chicago. But the conventional way of treating heat waves until then, as especially in the media, was you break eggs and see how long it takes them to fry on the streets. You treat it as a kind of light summer story. There's typically a lot of reporting on the race to get air conditioners before they sell out of appliance stores and things like that. Well, this heat system was more severe than usual. The temperatures reached 106 degrees, and the heat index, which we discussed briefly before, topped 120. And there were about 2.5 days where Chicago was just broiling without relief. And one of the big things that happened in 1995 is that because of the urban heat island effect, which means the city kind of attracts and then also traps heat, the temperature did not cool significantly at night. So even the low temperatures were above 80 degrees. And the city just began to break down, and its infrastructure broke down. There were places where the bridges were malfunctioning, where railroads were malfunctioning, but the civic infrastructure was collapsing as well. And over the course of several days, it became clear that this was not a light summer story. About 739 people in excess of the norm died during the week of the heat wave. Thousands were hospitalized with heat-related illnesses. And one of the really troubling signs of that week is that hundreds of people died alone and were not discovered for days, in some cases, or hours until after they died. Yet another troubling thing is that dozens of the victims were never claimed by anyone and were buried together in this kind of big ditch outside of Chicago in the suburb of Homewood. And so Heat Wave, my book, looks very closely at how and why this disaster happened, because what first intrigued me so much about the story is that when the climate scientists looked at the kind of models that predict how many people will die from certain weather conditions, they realized that there's just a massive number of deaths that were unpredicted or unaccountable to the weather. There had to be some kind of social or political story there. And I spent about 5 years investigating how the city responded and failed to respond, frankly. Yeah.
And just on the subject, though, of the natural part of this, I was really struck that just recently the Lancet, which is the big British medical journal, they recently declared global warming will be, and of course one could argue about global warming, but they said global warming will be the greatest threat to human health this century. And one thing that they specifically mentioned was that we should expect there will be more heat waves.
Yeah, and you know, I think you're right. We could argue about global warming, but I actually think it's long past time for us to stop arguing about global warming. I mean, with the Bush administration is gone. It's time for the United States to join the rest of the rational world in dealing with this as a major public health issue. It's about the future of all of us at every level, and there's just no question that we're seeing from almost everyone in the scientific community. Predictions that we will see, in addition to the gradual increase in the Earth's temperature, we will see a spike in extreme weather systems, and heat waves are the obvious ones. In fact, a very recent report that comes from the U.S. government predicts a dramatic increase in the number of heat waves in Chicago and also in the severity of heat waves in Chicago. So this is not anything that we can expect to go away.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the fact that there was a criticism of the government, the city government in Chicago, for perhaps not being more proactive. And as you said, with a heat wave and with other kinds of weather, you can see it coming. It should not take you by surprise. And at the same time, though, I think the response, the actual response of the city was something like, hey, it's summer, it's hot, what do you want us to do about
this?
Well,
it was a comedy of errors. It wasn't that. I mean, one that heat disasters and summer disasters in general is that there's a kind of longstanding pattern where the elites get out of town. They get out of big cities, obviously not just Chicago. It happens in many places in the world. And so when you have a catastrophe, many of the kind of key personnel who would handle them are not around. And in the case of the heat wave, the mayor was out of town. Several of the people who ran key agencies were out of town. And if there were a hurricane that were about to hit Chicago, you can bet that the mayor would be there. But, again, because of the way that we used to report on heat waves, that just wasn't seen as being all that significant. And so you had these kind of political leaders who were at their beach houses in Michigan and Indiana, while the kind of ordinary people in the city were left to broil. I say a comedy of errors because literally the city of Chicago had a heat emergency plan that it had developed on the books in the health department, and they simply forgot that it was there and didn't run a heat emergency plan. The fire commissioner refused to allow additional ambulances to go out and assist in the effort or to hire additional paramedics and pay them overtime, even though the city was lagging behind its standard response times. There were so many problems with the response. And the one thing that the city did do quite aggressively was this kind of public relations campaign to say, as you mentioned, look, this is just ordinary summer weather, or you can't blame all these deaths on the heat. And in fact, the city quite aggressively challenged the medical examiner when he was making his findings that you know, so many people were dying of the heat. You have to understand that the scene in the center of the city was about 10 50-foot-long refrigerated meatpacking trucks had to be driven into the coroner's office, which is just west of the loop, because they literally ran out of bays to store dead bodies. It was just this incredible spectacle of death. And you've got the official branches of the city questioning whether the disaster was really real. So it was an event that was politically disturbing. You know, one clearly gets the sense that you could not have a response like that if it were residents of the Gold Coast who were dropping dead. But I had to say, and I make this argument very clearly in my book, it's kind of silly to say that this happened simply because of a political breakdown. There's much more to the story than that, because if you have a case where you have hundreds of people who die alone and isolated in their homes or apartments, this is a kind of social breakdown where you know, families are part of the story, communities are part of the story, neighborhood systems are part of the story, social service agencies are part of the story. If the media is not issuing appropriate kinds of public alerts, then they become part of the story as well. And so what I've become very interested in is my work as a social scientist is saying, let's not just simply point the finger of blame. Let's make sure that our political organizations are accountable when they don't do the right thing. Let's make sure we learn from our mistakes, which is why I call my book a social autopsy. But let's also look at this in a kind of neutral and holistic way and try to really understand how it is that our societies break down during crises.
Yeah. Well, that's, as I mentioned just briefly when I was talking about the subjects of your research, one of the things that you're interested in is this increase in the numbers of people who live alone.
That's right.
That certainly played a role here. Is that something that you think, in no matter what kind of thing that you were talking about, in any kind of emergency disaster situation, whether it's something that just strikes in the blink of an eye or it's something that in a sense we can see coming, that this people who are isolated alone, is that, do you think, something that's going to become increasingly an issue?
It is already an issue. It will become ever more one. Because we're not just talking about people who are increasingly living alone. We're also talking about aging alone. And, you know, from Chicago to Hurricane Katrina, where there are large concentrations of death among the elderly and people who live alone, we've seen that this has become a big risk factor. So one of the ideas that I've kind of pushed for is that we have not just a changing climate, but we have a broad kind of formula for disaster. And one of the key elements of this is the increasing likelihood that people will age alone. It takes a lot of work to take care of people who are aging alone on a daily basis, not just during disasters. And so the extreme weather systems exacerbate what I think are extraordinary everyday challenges that we have to deal with. And it, you know, this is a very significant problem. You know, and again, it's not just in Chicago. It's in many different cities and communities. Another risk factor I think we have to deal with is the kind of everyday deprivation and vulnerability of very poor communities. And one of the trends that I noted in my heatwave book, and that I think is becoming pressing once again, is the incredible polarization of wealth and resources in the United States. We live in an economy that tends to generate incredible inequality. We're famous for inequality in Chicago, but it can be quite severe in the U.S. in general. And that there are clusters of neighborhoods and communities that are really identifiable throughout the country, where there is just a heightened level of vulnerability every day. And so it's one thing to age alone in Lincoln Park in Chicago, where you have a lot of resources, a lot of social service agencies, a lot of things to draw people out of their homes and into public life in the streets. But it's a very different kind of thing to age alone on the far west side or on the south side in the neighborhoods that have more poverty, more violence, and fewer resources that invite public engagement. You know, few movie theaters, few grocery stores, places where you can go out and get relief. And so what this means for disaster planning is heightened vulnerability, but also that the ability to pinpoint places where you really need to devote resources. And I think a responsible public reaction to a disaster would be to send emergency personnel to those places where we would predict high levels of suffering. Unfortunately, what often happens is that those areas are also areas that lack the political clout that determines what resources go where. And so you see this kind of doubling of the inequality. The areas that kind of need help least tend to get it the most. Mm.
Just to round this out a little bit, certainly heat in the summer in Chicago is something that we should just expect. And then from time to time, it's going to be even worse than the average. There was another severe heat wave in Chicago 10 years ago in 1999. Do you think the city did better?
Yeah, and I wrote about this in the conclusion of my book. I mean, the city of Chicago has really developed an exemplary heat response program, and it seems to their credit that they now take this more seriously. So, and there are a number of things that Chicago does, and that I would like to see other cities do when extreme heat approaches. You know, Chicago in some ways has learned from that experience in 1995. They got a lot of pressure to do it also, but the city has, for instance, developed a list of vulnerable people who live alone, and it uses its city employees and volunteers to call out to them directly to check in to see if they're okay. The city had a plan to use its community policing officers to actually do checkups on people and their beats. They failed to implement that in 1995 when it was also on the books, but they increasingly do it today. They use more public transportation to get people air conditioning, if they can't otherwise get it, than they did in the past. And then another really key thing, which is the most basic and cost-effective way to deal with a heat wave in advance, is that they treat the thing seriously as a health hazard, and they reach out to local media to make sure that you don't get the meteorologist frying eggs, but instead get really serious coverage of heat as a health hazard. And you know, I wish we saw that kind of response in cities all over the place, but unfortunately, and this has been another theme of my research, it oftentimes takes a direct experience with a catastrophe like this to change behavior. And also, unfortunately, we have a history of forgetting what we learn very quickly. And the truth is, when you look at America's responses to a number of different threats, we just have a tendency to prioritize something when it's right before us or when it's just happened, but then to move on to other kinds of things and other worries as it fades into the historical past. So, you know, the question now is how long will Chicago retain its ability to do this kind of thing, and what kind of thing will we begin to worry about next?
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Eric Kleinenberg. He's professor of sociology at New York University, and in his academic work, he's interested in a number of things, including urban studies and also risk and disaster. His first book was titled Heat Wave, a social autopsy of disaster in Chicago that looks at what happened in Chicago in the summer of 1995. It is published by the University of Chicago Press. His second book is Fighting for Air, the Battle to Control America's Media. He's now working on two new projects that have to do with urban security, disaster expertise, also the rise in living alone, and certainly, as he has discussed, there are connections between those two things. In addition to his books and his scholarly work, he's written for a number of publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, London Review of Books, The Nation, The Washington Post, Mother Jones, The Guardian, and others. We're talking this morning about disaster preparedness and response, and if you have questions or comments, you're welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to take a moment or two and have you to talk a little bit more about the media. And you were talking earlier about the fact that maybe in the past and maybe still, when it comes to something like a heat wave, for example, that the media are they're frying eggs on the sidewalk. And so on the one hand, it could be that something like that in the way that media report the story were trivializing it or making light of it or not acknowledging how serious it is. I suppose the other side of that is are there times when, in the way that we report stories, where the tone is a little bit too nervous and that perhaps, again, rather than giving people good, solid information on what it is and what they can do, we're getting people unnecessarily worked up about it. And so, that, you know, is it possible to, or how difficult it is to find some kind of good middle ground between panicking people and in trivializing what is really a serious issue?
Yeah, well, first let me say that this is actually a tough balance to find, and I think there are a lot of journalists who work very hard to reach it and do it successfully, so I don't want to be too sweeping in my criticisms. But then I should also say that I think we've just lived through one of these cases where media really did whip up some unnecessary hysteria or panic, in part by reporting on panic that wasn't really there. And in this case, I'm referring to coverage of the swine flu or the H1N1 virus, which we should still have many concerns about. The virus could mutate. It could become far more dangerous and deadly than it was this time around. And you know, so I hope you follow the story over the next few months and into the fall, when there are a number of public health challenges that we face, and I'd be happy to talk about them more. But this time around, the media really did play up the panic story when, in fact, you couldn't see much panic, at least here in the United States. I had a very personal experience with this, which I actually reported on in a very, I think, a funny exchange on the great NPR program on the media, which is that I tend to get a lot of calls when bad things are happening in the world, given the nature of my work, and so my phone started to ring a lot when the flu was starting to come to the U.S. and particularly New York, and I got one call from a national news network which wanted to do a story about why people in New York City were panicking so dramatically about the possibility that they would get swine flu. And I said to the reporter, look, you know, this is an email exchange. I said, I'd be happy to talk to you about the story, but I have to say that if there's kind of one robust finding from the sociology of disaster over the years, it's that people, ordinary people, rarely panic at the outbreak of a disaster. You might see panicky people at the running big organizations who make bad decisions, but most people do not panic. I said, you know, if you look on the streets of New York City today, you do not see people wearing masks, surgical masks, for instance. People are doing very little to protect themselves. People, for the most part, are not pulling their kids from schools. They're going to work. The subways are very crowded. You know, yes, there's a spike in people going to hospitals to get tests because people are nervous or anxious, but that's very different from panicking. And so I think you need to be really careful about this. So she kind of took this information down, and the ABC News published a story on its website, which was all about this kind of panic pandemic. And then the images that they used for the story included a mushroom cloud, a deadly insect, a man in a hazmat suit. I mean, the story read as if people were freaking out left and right, and there's just no evidence of that. And I think that the media can contribute to our anxiety and make us feel like we have more at risk than we do in a particular outbreak. And I think the media oftentimes fail to recognize that a little bit of anxiety can be healthy, a kind of nervousness can be okay. You want to closely follow something that could potentially put you at risk, but that's very different from panic.
All right. Well, we have some callers to bring into our conversation. The number is 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have someone to start us off in Urbana, line one. Hello. It's a caller there, line one. Hold on.
Yeah?
There, we got you. Go ahead.
Okay. Good morning.
Yes.
I'm interested to know if the procedures and methodology for disaster preparation are actually well documented and known to municipalities and, you know, universities and so forth. For example, and I've heard recently that Southern California had a very, very good disaster drill for general disaster, you know, fires, earthquake, that kind of thing. And I'm wondering if the procedures that they use were somehow available to other municipalities so that no town needs to be unprepared.
I think that no town does need to be unprepared. But we need to recognize that there's a lot of local variation and how you'd want to deal with an evacuation, for instance, from one place to another. There's variation in how you'd want to plan a dispersal of an antiviral if there were a flu pandemic or something like that. So I think there are lots of general principles and principles that I think would apply to communities everywhere and that would be useful for all kinds of hazards. And when you hear about the all hazards model of disaster preparation, which was very popular during the Clinton years in FEMA, but that kind of lost its status when DHS took over FEMA, that's what we're referring to. And so the ideal is to have that set of more general guidelines come from the federal government, for instance, and then to have local variations that are established by the municipality where you live. Now that can be done if it's a priority of a Department of Homeland Security or of a federal readiness initiative. And what you should know that the government does maintain a website called ready.gov, www.ready.gov, that has a lot of the basic information that any community would need there. But unfortunately, my view is that what happened after September 11th is that the Department of Homeland Security really shifted the energy of FEMA and of other programs that were designed to deal with disaster preparedness towards a more exclusive focus on anti-terrorism. And, you know, I teach at New York University. I live in Lower Manhattan. I'm very close to the World Trade Center, so I'm sensitive about the reasons that we would want to focus on anti-terrorism. But at the same time, we can't do it at the neglect or at the expense of preparation for other kinds of hazards. If what we care about is securing the homeland and protecting Americans, then we clearly need to look at a broad range of threats, including things like heat waves and flu pandemics. And my view is just the kind of political priorities of Washington, D.C. shifted after September 11th. And as a result, many communities are less prepared for the things that they're likely to deal with than they should be. And I would very much like to see a change in this. And as I said before, I'm just not sure at this point what the Obama administration will do with respect to leadership here.
Interesting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Next, someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. Yep. I have a question about evacuation plans. Looking at what happened at Hurricane Katrina and even more so at Hurricane Rita, where people were trying to evacuate Houston, and I don't see how it's really realistic for people to try to evacuate on highways. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that and whether there are plans to evacuate by highways that you think are at all feasible. Thank you. I'll hang up.
Yeah, I mean, what we know about evacuation, which runs counter to some of the mythology out there, actually, is that people will evacuate when given orders to do so. Remember, there's a lot of concern that people in New Orleans weren't evacuating, but in fact, the overwhelming majority of people in New Orleans got out of town. And as you mentioned, in fact, the problem is often the reverse, that so many people evacuate that you have clogging of the highways and log jam. And, you know, again, as someone who lives in Manhattan and has a family, I'm concerned about this issue. You know, how do you get off the island? I think we don't have adequate ways to deal with this problem in some cities that would be difficult to evacuate. On the other hand, when you have a situation in which a disaster is forecast and you can see a hurricane or some other extreme weather system coming in advance, aggressive planning can actually help the evacuation process move quickly if you get people going early enough. Clearly, we need to look seriously at ways of using mass transportation more than private vehicles. A car could keep you trapped, especially if you're trying to get out of a place like Manhattan. But in my view, this is a difficult one, but one that needs to be addressed as far in advance as you possibly can do it.
All right. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Eric Kleinenberg. He's a professor of sociology at New York University and is interested in urban studies and risk and disaster. He's the author of the book Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. That book is about the response to the heat wave of 1995, summer of 1995. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. He is interested in things like urban security, disaster expertise, and also something that is very much connected, that is the dramatic rise around the United States of the numbers in the numbers of people who live alone. And questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So I want to go back to something that you touched on just a little bit, and that is individuals and their disaster preparedness. And certainly, I think in media they have tried to give some advice on how it is that people can prepare. And certainly there are a lot of resources like that available. For example, here I'm looking at that webpage of ready.gov, and right there, there's lots of information on what households can do to try and be prepared to deal with a kind of emergency. And then what happens is, as you mentioned, if you go out and you ask people, have you done any of this kind of thing, that I think there's actually some level of awareness about maybe what they should be doing, but they say, well, actually, no, we haven't. So then if you say, well, how's come? Why is it that you really haven't done anything? What do people say?
This is a really interesting question, and I wrote a piece of the New York Times Magazine last year around this time on this very issue, just because it's so intriguing. I mean, there are many people who will not prepare for a disaster because they face enough pressures in their everyday lives that it's just untenable. So it's hard to ask people to store food if they're hungry on a day-to-day basis. It can be expensive to supply, radio and flashlights and all the kind of backup things that Ready.gov tells you to stock up on if you're living from paycheck to paycheck. And so for some part of the population, you can see why it's hard to prepare. But for the great majority of us, that's not the case. In fact, it's relatively easy to do this, and yet most of us don't. So why is that? Clearly, part of it is the kind of legacy of distrust that most of us have for the kind of governmental suggestions on how to stay safe. So the Cold War ideas about bomb shelters in the event of a nuclear holocaust, or the color-coded alerts that we got from the DHS system, did not exactly encourage us to have faith that these recommendations from government would be all that useful. So when government gives really bad advice, it actually can be destructive insofar as it means that people just don't listen anymore. I think one of the things that I learned when I organized a series of focus groups here in Manhattan a few years ago is that it can be difficult to prepare for disaster because it means dwelling on the possibility of something extremely unpleasant. To sit down and have a family discussion about how you'll communicate with one another if something terrible happens and the landlines go down and the cell phones go down, where you'll meet each other, what your plans for coordinating are. That really takes sitting and thinking about the possibility of this horrific thing, and most of us just don't want to do that. I think there are other people who feel fatalistic about it, that something is unlikely to happen that's so catastrophic that they need to be prepared. And if it does, what happens happens. Others have incredible faith in the community that they're part of. They feel that they have enough resources to get by, and if they don't, they'll be able to go to their friends and their neighbors and mutually support each other through the crisis. Now, interestingly, there's a lot of evidence for that view in the history of catastrophes. As I said before, people can be extraordinarily civil, sometimes even joyous, in the aftermath of disaster. One could argue that crises bring out the best of us, at least immediately after they happen. But I think this question about why we do such a bad job preparing is one that we still have not fully answered.
Yeah. Well, you've mentioned some of the things that are always commonly advise to people? And you know, we've talked about it here, for example, because here, well, we could have a tornado, or you could have a time when the power might be off. So you need to make sure that you have some people. The advice is, you know, make sure that you have some water, make sure that you have some food, make sure that you have a little cash on hand. If you depend on some kind of prescription medication, make sure you have it, and that,
that's right.
That if and that you know that if you have to run out the door and go who knows where, you'd better, if there are essential things that you have to have, you'd better have them close at hand so that you can grab it and you can leave. And,
yeah.
You know, so we tell people all that stuff. And it sounds as if most people say, yeah, I hear that. But of course, I mean, I haven't done it, and most people haven't. So is that a losing proposition here, that we can continue to tell people those things and suggest people those things, but that we should expect that most people just won't do it?
Well, I think you have to have some humility about how successful you're going to be with this kind of planning. I mean, we just have a lot of evidence at this point that people are more concerned about other kinds of things. You know, on the other hand, you have to take advantage of teachable moments and do whatever you can to make sure that the lessons last, right? This is something I take seriously as an educator, as well as a social scientist. And when you have crises, you have teachable moments. And in the same way that people in Chicago are now much more sensitive about heat waves and actually will check up on their elderly relatives and their neighbors in ways they didn't before, you know, you can push for people and also for governments to change the way they behave, at least with respect to the particular kinds of crises that we deal with. So there are probably far more people this week who are thinking about what to do in the event of a flu pandemic than there were a few months ago. And maybe one thing to do is just to be very aggressive about promoting education around these kinds of events. And I think keeping the discussion going is another way we can help. I mean, that typically the way that media report on this issue is that when there's something that's about to happen or that just happened, we give it a lot of attention. And then it just disappears from the media's purview as well. And so perhaps as we move into this kind of age of insecurity, where we're becoming more sensitive to catastrophes, natural and also man-made, these kinds of discussions, like the one we're having today, will become a more common part of our culture. Mm-hmm. And clearly, the federal government wants to promote what it calls a culture of preparedness. You know, you want to do this without scaremongering. You want to do this without turning everyone into a survivalist. But I think you do want to promote a culture in which we all are kind of reasonably informed about what the risks are, and as well prepared as we can be. And I think given that a lot of people will not ever be perfectly prepared, you also want to make sure that local government agencies and community leaders or community organizations are themselves prepared. And one of the things that I've written about and that remains a big concern for me is that in the event that there's a crisis and it falls out along the same lines that we've seen in the past, that the most vulnerable communities suffer the most, we need to recognize that it's these kind of local community organizations and institutions that will play a leading role in the response. And one of my concerns, especially during a major economic downturn like the one we have right now, is that the organizations, the social service agencies and community organizations that work with the most vulnerable people in our society now are themselves cash-strapped. They are themselves living from paycheck to paycheck, really struggling to provide all the kinds of services that they need to. And so for them, preparing for disasters is essential, but also very difficult. And there's a group out in the Bay Area of California called the Fritz Institute, and I'd encourage your listeners to check out their website as well. It's the Fritz Institute, and they have a program called Bay Prep. And Bay Prep was designed to work with the organizations in San Francisco that protect the vulnerable and the poor and the elderly so that they were ready for the next crisis, and they're particularly concerned about earthquake management. But this, for me, is a kind of a model program that should be replicated in communities around the United States, and unfortunately, it's just not getting a lot of attention.
We have about 5 minutes left. We have a couple of callers here. We'll go next to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, is that I?
Yes.
Hello, I'm quite interested in this topic as a Red Cross disaster volunteer who has been trained after Katrina, because I didn't have money to give, but I had time to give. What I'd like to respond to are a couple of the things that you've talked about. One, in terms of being prepared, you can be pretty sure that our country is set up with strategic stockpiles of food and water and other things. But when people are told to evacuate and there is a disaster, they need to have a photo identification and proof of their residence, or they will not receive any services. So that's one thing to add to the evacuation kit. There are classes especially in this community, Champaign-Urbana Office of the Red Cross, they cancel the classes because there aren't enough participants to take the classes. They're free, they're open to everyone, and they really help get people aware and involved in their own preparedness, as well as in the fact that they are going to be ready when there is any kind of disaster to be right there and start helping immediately. So those are some things that I didn't hear about in your presentation. Also, as far as drills in this area, I myself have participated in a drill in Danville about nerve gas, a drill in Paxton for air crash, in Bloomington for medical distribution. We do drills. I don't know, and they usually are observed and evaluated by outside observers. So things are happening. You know, maybe they're not happening enough, and maybe they're not happening to the extent that that's not state of the art, but they are happening. I just would encourage people to join in, not necessarily to give money, but to become a part of the community organizations that are immediately in service when a small or a large disaster happens.
Yeah, let me just say, I think that's terrific, and there's a significant number of people in communities throughout the country who are doing an extraordinary amount of volunteer work to prepare themselves, but also to prepare to be leaders in the event that something happens to their community and or to a community nearby, and they can help. And this is just terrific work, and it should be applauded. I think there are additional questions which have to do with how to do kind of basic education and basic preparation for the majority of people who will not participate in those kinds of things. And I think that's a formidable challenge. But no doubt in Champaign-Urbana and communities throughout the country, we have people who are putting in extraordinary energy into these kinds of projects already, and without them we'd be in real trouble.
Yeah, I want to thank the caller. I want to see if we can get one more here in Champaign County. Line 2, go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to return to the cash-strapped social service agencies, and I don't know if you're following politics here, but we have an impasse almost probably per capita worse than California in a way, and the already underfunded network of home health care and the other helping services are just really under threat here, and this kind of network needs to be nurtured and kept going, and even just the threat that it's going to be zeroed out in a lot of ways is just astonishing. As far as media reporting, the local paper has a guy who's "I'm all right, Jack," and is just lampooning anybody who's calling attention to this. He's saying that Pat Quinn is committing a crime as worse as Blagojevich because he's using DSC, which disabled children, as props in his battle. It's astonishing to see it, and I just think that in the moment you have less, I think that the social services that are already underfunded are just so important in terms of disaster. It's nice to have volunteers like Red Cross person that just called in, but the network that's on the ground that already has established relations, knows where the people are, would be so important. And This Tom Kasich is going to rue the day he penned this if we have actually a disaster that happens that causes I don't know.
I think he said that very eloquently, yeah. And I think you've made this two very important points, and one is as we kind of overhaul our welfare state during this terrible economic crisis. We're making very consequential decisions about how to provide social support and to what extent we'll provide social support to the most vulnerable among us. And, you know, we could use our collective resources to alleviate suffering and to protect people in ways that they have not been protected before by providing them with health care and home health care if necessary and other kinds of support. You know, or we could choose not to do that and say that this is something the government can't handle. Now, I think that we would be best served by being generous and taking care of one another. And historically, during downturns like this, there have been great outpourings of support because people understand that they themselves could be made vulnerable and destitute very quickly, that the kind of broader economic forces at work in the world could very quickly put them in harm's way and take apart the kind of lifeline of support and resources they depend on. You know, and I'm hoping that that we live up to the challenge of protecting the least secure among us at this moment. But I think it's very unclear how this will play out from state to state.
Yeah.
The other thing you mentioned, I think, is significant, has to do with the media. And, you know, you talk about a kind of shock jock who, you know, belittles efforts to protect the vulnerable. But there's another thing going on as well, which is just the total devastation to local media throughout the country and the real loss of the kind of professional reporters who were calling attention to these very issues, whether they have to do with poverty and suffering or whether they have to do with vulnerability and disaster preparation. And I'm concerned about this as well.
We have to leave it at that. Our guest, Eric Kleinenberg, is professor of sociology at New York University. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Pleasure to be here.